The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, the conscience of psychiatry. We may be having a little trouble making contact with my marvelous guest today, so we'll see how that goes. There's plenty we can talk about. But first, I want to tell you about my wife, Ginger. Some of you know what kind of a wonderful partner she is and what a partner I am to her, how we really conduct this large-scale reform work, sometimes seeming to people like we must have an office of 20 when it's basically Ginger and me backing her up. Well, Ginger, as of last week, became a blogger on Huffington Post. So we're again a team that way, except we both have our own individual blogs. She has her first blog up, and you can go to it just by going to Huffington Post and put in the search Ginger Bragan. She's going to blog about a lot of different things, connecting them a lot to psychology and psychiatry. But she's a very imaginative person with wide-ranging interests, and I think she's going to have one of the very more interesting blogs in the world. Her blog this time, her opening blog, is about a fellow named Watson, who was the early formulator of behaviorism, and that led very much to Skinner. In the beginning, there were Watson, and there was Pavlov, Watson in the U.S. and overlapping with Pavlov in Russia. And they had this profound influence on psychology, basically ripping the person out of the person and trying to treat human beings as if they were objects that could be observed and manipulated. And Skinner carried on that tradition, was the darling of the New York Times, wrote bestsellers talking about how basically there's no one at home. And Ginger writes about this and the implications of it. It's a very appropriate lead into my guest today, whom we did make contact with, Robert Foltz, F-O-L-T-Z, Bob Foltz, F-O-L-T-Z. He's a PsyD psychologist, clinical psychologist in Chicago. Later on, he can give you his contact information. He is the sort of psychologist you might want to be in contact with. And Bob is in the tradition that's the opposite of the behavioral psychology and modern psychiatry viewpoint of the human being, that there's no one at home. For Bob, as for me and for Ginger and for so many other of us, the most important thing there is in psychology is the subjective experience of the person that we're relating to. Not our diagnosis, not our explanation, not our superimposition upon to that person, but instead our subjective, our knowledge of their subjective experience, and of course, and most important, their growing knowledge of themselves. I think Bob will find this a somewhat adequate description of a communality we have. Bob is assistant professor of psychology at the Psychology School of Professional Psychology. He's interested in all ages, I'm sure, but teaches more in the area of child and adolescence. And I'm really looking forward to hearing Bob talk about his work, learning about studying, promoting the subjective experience of children and adolescents, how they really feel about treatment, how they really feel about their lives, how they really feel about psychiatric drugs. Bob, welcome to the show for the second time.
Hi, thanks. Thanks. I'm glad to be here. And your intro was just perfect. The subjective experience is something that I really have been looking into more and more. And I'm hoping today that I can talk a little bit about some research I've been doing in that respect. But yeah, that is definitely something you and I have in common.
Bob, hold on one sec. We're getting a bit of a hum.
Okay.
I don't know if that's from your phone or if that can be handled in the studio. I think maybe there's just no way we're able to fix it for some reason. So bear with us because Bob has a lot of really important things to say. So go ahead, Bob, pick up on that, how you've been studying this issue.
Okay, well, before I started teaching at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, I had been working in residential treatment for many years. And in residential care, that's typically the type of treatment setting where you're going to encounter children and adolescents with really severe conditions, those kids that can't be maintained in the home. And typically in those treatment settings, they're going to get a wide range of different treatment approaches, all of them applied at the same time, and it's really tough to discern what's working and not working in those settings. So having gotten the opportunity now to kind of enter the academic realm and still, you know, I wanted to keep my feet in residential to some degree, I've gotten the ability to run a research program in which we are going into residential treatment centers and interviewing adolescents about their experience of treatment, what they think works and what they think doesn't work, related to therapy and medications and milieu approaches, and just that full constellation of are they connecting to adults or do they just feel like they're being controlled, and to what degree, and what's working and what's not working.
And what are you finding?
Well, it's really been fascinating. Part of, you know, as you mentioned early in the introduction about diagnosing, one of the things that we've stumbled into, and I guess it's pretty accurate from my years of experience, but depending on which clinician they're sitting down with really determines the trajectory of their treatment. Part of what the research is collecting background information on all the kids that are participating. And if you take a look at what these kids have been through, like their exposure to trauma, it is just off the charts. I mean, these kids that are placed in residential treatment, for the most part, have been just horribly traumatized. One of the measures we're using is the Adverse Childhood Experiences measure, and that has 10 different categories of trauma that we're tracking in all these kids. So if you look at their social histories, it's just very troubled. And these kids would have every reason in the world to be upset and angry and agitated and unregulated, as clinicians would call it. So if you only look at the behavioral presentation, that's where you start to see all these unregulated behaviors, the emotional volatility, the aggression, the anger towards adults, the inability to trust people, and that's what starts to guide the diagnosis. So that behavioral constellation of symptoms very often leads to bipolar disorder or being called bipolar disorder or post-traumatic stress or conduct disorder, which of course leads to a primary approach of medication. So, you know, these kids, in our sample, we've got a variety of kids, most of which are diagnosed with bipolar disorder, many of which are on multiple medications to control all these agitated behaviors. So, but then we're looking into their social histories and realizing that these are just very traumatized kids. And the approach of medicating them is not even, you know, the trauma is not even hitting the radar. So that's one of the major, what illuminated for us immediately. And in terms of their response to medication, only about, I'm trying to pull up the exact figure, only a quarter of the kids are feeling positive about being on medications. So, and just over 40% are feeling negative about it. So there's a big disparity right there. And then there are some kids in the middle that say, I don't want to be on them, but they seem to help in my day-to-day functioning. But just a small portion of the kids actually want to be on their medications. And so we're trying to figure out who are the kids that are responding well to medications and what are those profiles of the kids that definitely don't want to be on medications but end up being put on medications. Because if they can do something different behaviorally, maybe they can avoid the whole medication route entirely.
Well, you know, Bob, I'd be more worried about the kids who think they're getting positive effects from the medication.
Yeah.
Because we know the medications can only put them out of touch with their feelings and maybe subdue their behaviors and ingratiate themselves with the doctors. I'm surprised that all the kids don't say they like the meds just to ingratiate themselves with the docs.
Well,
I'd really be more worried about the kids who say they're getting helped.
Yeah, that's a great point. And part of what we're looking at, too, is are those kids that are positive responders indicating positive feedback throughout the survey? So are they just telling us what we want to hear, so to speak? Because we also have, when you compare the medication to the feelings of being in therapy, so only 24 or 26% want to be on or feel good about being on their medications, compared to 66% that feel good about being in therapy. I mean, that is a dramatic difference. But back to your point, you know, it starts to address that issue of the placebo effect too. You know, I do not doubt that there are some people out there that are feeling like, well, the doctor says this is supposed to be helping. And, you know, part of it, what we're looking into is the mindset of the direct care staff. Because in residential treatment settings, it's not at all uncommon for bad behavior to be associated or equated with being noncompliant with your medication. So if kids are aggressive, they keep getting the message from the staff of like, well, you wouldn't be aggressive if you took your medication. So it could just be those seeds being planted over an extended period of time for those kids that think, well, I'm aggressive, so I need my medications. But, yeah, I think you make a great point. And we're trying to figure out, too, because we're looking at IQ differences and diagnostic differences, all the different variables that could kind of paint the picture of who is feeling good about being on medication.
I just want to hear you talking more and more about this whole issue of trying to get the subjective responses. And I think that one thing that comes out right away to me is that when you're in an institution, the kids can't leave if they want, can they?
No.
I mean, they are
no,
involuntary, basically.
Yeah, they're pretty much a captured audience. Now, at least in Illinois, you can't have a locked residential unit, but these kids can definitely not leave if they want to. It's not
so
like
everything gets colored by the fact that they're prisoners, everything about
right.
their responses. And I know you're sophisticated enough, I know you're very sophisticated, so that you've got to be aware of that. I mean, do you think you're able to get around that by winning trust when you're testing the kids and talking with them?
Well, it's a great point. I mean, part of what we go into it with is telling them that their specific answers are not going to be shared with anybody in their facility. In hopes that, you know, they'll feel more comfortable. And over time, I mean, the interview that we're doing takes about an hour with each child. And we're feeling, it's me and some graduate students from the Chicago School, and we're feeling like we're getting some pretty good feedback for them. But the point you're making, and all of these youth are, very few of them are fresh to the system, so to speak. So they've all been through the child welfare system here in Illinois for an extended period of time. Now, that in and of itself kind of paints that atmosphere that you're talking about of, you know, things are just being done to them rather than with them. So, but there are some other questions that we're asking that are asking the same questions in different ways in hopes of trying to tease out the reliability of what they're telling us. But I think for the most part, what my experience has been is that the kids do feel feel pretty comfortable talking to us. And part of my experience has been there are more and more kids that by the end of the interview, they're asking us, why can't you share this with my treatment team? Or why doesn't my therapist ask me these questions? So I think what we've tried to do is really tap into their kind of lived experience of being in treatment, and we're asking questions that they don't typically get answered or don't typically get asked. We're trying to get the answers to.
I think it's great that I think roughly two-thirds of them of the youngsters feel that therapy is something they want and it helps them. We hear this all the time. I mean, if you survey mental hospital patients who've been in there for 30 days or whatever before their insurance runs out, in general what you hear is, I didn't get to talk with anybody enough, or what really mattered to me was the 10 minutes the nurse talked to me.
Mm-hmm.
People need human contact. They yearn for guidance and help. When they're in distress, they really yearn for it, and it's got to be even more so with these youngsters. What is the age range of these people?
They are 13 to 18, so they're all adolescents. And to your point, I mean, one of the questions is, to what extent do you feel having a good connection with your therapist makes a difference? And 92% of them said that connection makes a difference in terms of how effective therapy is then. You know, another thing that was really surprising to us is that a good portion, the majority of the kids are indicating that they know they need to talk about difficult life experiences in order to get better. Now, in residential care, these are kids that, like I said, have been through the system quite a bit, but there's still that awareness that when the opportunity is there, they know that they should talk about these difficult, traumatic experiences that they have had. And that it is also going to require that in order to get better, which I think really demonstrates some insight on their part. Even though these kids are, you know, comorbid with multiple diagnoses and may have some cognitive limitations, it really speaks to their acknowledgement that, yeah, life has been difficult, and I know that once I work through all that stuff, I'm going to be doing better.
Yeah, that's wonderful, and that's quite astonishing and amazing. Now, talking about this reminds me of a mutual friend of ours and whom we respect, psychiatrist Tony Stanton from out west. And when Tony was working in somewhat similar, I imagine, residential treatment setting for lost souls, really, kids with no place to go, one of the things he used to like to do was to, on the front of each kid's chart, put a very simple, straightforward description of how horrible their lives had been, what they had been through, so that the staff could keep in mind what you were saying, that these external behaviors, the anger, the hostility, the difficulty relating, and the emotional instability, that all of that has a history. It's about a person and what a person's been through.
Yeah, and you know, the adverse childhood experiences study that came out, I think it was back in the mid-90s, and the reason we're using that questionnaire really demonstrated. It took, I think, just over 17,000 adults and looked retrospectively at the trauma they had experienced before the age of 18, and then tried to look at all the implications of that now that these people were adults. And there were significant mental health problems. There were significant drug abuse problems. There was just a wide array of physical health problems. So exposure to any one of those traumas dramatically increases the likelihood of future health problems. And one of their findings was, if you had four or more of those adverse experiences in your life, you had 100% chance of being put on antidepressant medication. So
that,
four out of the 10, four or more of those. And just in terms of our sample, our average for exposure in these kids is 4.6. So the vast majority of the kids we're working with in residential care have had four or more of these. In fact, some of them have had all 10 traumatic experiences or categories. So, it's a very troubled population of kids, and the implications for what they've been through are profound. I mean, they could really, they're really going to have a long road ahead of them. And if we just rely on managing their symptoms through medications, very little is going to improve in the long term for them.
Well, I think we know now that will get worse and worse for them. We now know the meds are shrinking brain tissue, especially the antipsychotics, which I'm sure a lot of these kids are on.
Yeah.
We know that the antidepressants are producing abnormal growth in the brain. We know that all the drugs really long-term are making people worse. And individuals who have been on antidepressants for years, studies are showing now, are more and more depressed, not better and better. So
yep.
We've got two fundamental truths here that the profession of psychiatry and really the mental health profession in general is ignoring. One, people become unhappy, miserable, angry, upset, depressed, unstable because of what they've been through. And the drugs in the long run are doing more harm than good. To me, it's now those are established facts.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the antipsychotics, over half of the kids in our sample are on antipsychotics. And of our sample, for the data, our preliminary data included 50 kids. And about 20 of them were on three or more psychotropic meds. But just over half of them were on antipsychotics as well. So it is a very medicated group. And that was part of my motivation to do this study in the first place. When I was working in residential, it is not at all uncommon to have kids on four medications. The most I ever saw was seven medications. And at that point, you don't know what's working, what's not working, what are side effects, what are symptoms. It's just very reckless in terms of the treatment that's going on. So, and that's why, you know, that changing the direction of that ship is very difficult, but I wanted to find out what the kids thought about receiving that kind of treatment, and that's really what started this whole project.
Well, I think the work you're doing is incredibly important, just incredibly important. It's going to really help move the profession, hopefully, you know, much more in the direction of really caring about what's going on inside these young people, what they've been through, what they really feel, what's really going to help them. Boy, it's a tough hoe, though. But the work you're doing is very, very important. Bob, say again what percentage of these 13 to, 18-year-olds or 17-year-olds?
Yeah, 13 to 18.
You know, what percentage are on some kind of psychiatric drug?
Oh, I think out of our sample of 50, we only had six kids not on medication. So that would mean about 85% were on
medication. Yeah, 88. That's six kids is 12%.
Okay, 88%. And two of the kids that were not on medications, it was noted in their file that they weren't on medications because they were consistently refusing. So the psychiatrist said, you know what, fine, I'm not going to fight this battle. You can be off your medications. So it's very rare that treatment includes not being on medications. It's far more common that these kids are on medications and typically multiple medications.
Yeah, we know now that the new new antipsychotic drugs like Seroquel, Risperdal, Abilify are really terrible for kids. You know, they cause obesity, they cause diabetes, they cause cardiac problems. They prepare these children not only to become chronic mental patients, but chronic cardiac patients. And then tardive dyskinesia. Of course, the risk is from all these medications. It must be heartbreaking for you at times.
Well, it's definitely, it is. I mean, it's really troubling. And it's, you know, like that group you mentioned about the ones that feel positive about it, when you know, in the back of my mind when I'm working with these kids and when you know that the road is so long and so difficult in front of them, when they're relying on just the medications, you know, like you mentioned, the antipsychotics, in recent years, just last year or the end of 2010, a study came out about antipsychotic use in very young children. And I think it was across a six-year period they were looking at the use. And in that time period, antipsychotic use for 2 to 5-year-olds doubled. So, I mean, there is just this growing trend towards just medicating. Now, I can't imagine what the justification would be to put a 2-year-old on antipsychotics. But unfortunately, you know, with this major trend of diagnosing kids with pediatric bipolar disorder, I think there's going to be, as much as it is now, I think it's even going to be increasing because of another recent study that came out just last year, I think in the fall, comparing all the antipsychotics to anticonvulsants in the treatment of adult acute mania. And what it seemed to demonstrate was the anticonvulsants were not particularly effective. The ones that seemed to show more effectiveness were the antipsychotics, in part because they're much more sedating and dulling of the affective experience. But because of that finding, I would bet that, you know, the momentum of this pediatric bipolar disorder is just going to be coupled then with using more and more antipsychotics to manage it.
Yeah, you can certainly stop anybody, any animal, any human, dead in their tracks with these drugs. I mean,
yep.
When you see the lion sedated and for surgery, you know, out in the wild, and he's still awake, but he's not fighting back. Part of what he's been injected with is an antipsychotic drug. They're lobotomizing agents.
Yeah.
They produce indifference, and it's such tragedy that we consider that a treatment.
Right, right.
When it is this chemical lobotomy. Bob, how can people get in touch with you? You have any phone numbers or a website or anything you'd like to tell people about?
Yeah.
You know, so they...
The easiest way to get in touch with me is probably through my email at my school address, and that email is rfoltz, so it's R, F as in Frank, O-L-T-Z, at thechicagoschool.edu. And then also if they go to the Chicago School website, you can find my faculty page there as well if they do a search for my name.
All right, give it one more time.
Okay, it's rfoltz. F-O-L-T-Z at thechicagoschool.edu. And the Chicago School is all one word.
And we're going to take a break in about 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Some of the things I'd love to talk to you about some more is one thing would be making vivid the experience of doing therapy with these youngsters and the kinds of things they share and talk about. Is that something you'd feel comfortable doing and given a few minutes to think about it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's something I try to do often on the show, and as I often say, it's really hard for therapists to talk about it. It's just not an easy thing to describe something about what is that experience like of working with people. What are you doing? What are they doing? How are they experiencing it? I know with the kids, it can be also heartbreaking, and it might be interesting for you to talk some about that. I know if I was working with children, I'd want to smuggle each and every one of them out of the facility, you know, and take them home.
Right,
as unethical and unfeasible as doing it in reality would be.
Right.
It's certainly a natural desire. It's just very heartbreaking and difficult to work with them. And another thing we might talk about is the response you're getting from both the children, the staff, and the psychiatrists. There's three really fairly separate groups.
Mm-hmm.
And to see what it's like for you in that regard. I think the work you're doing, where you're actually wanting to know what do the young people we're trying to treat actually think and feel, and encouraging them to be honest and giving them some anonymity so that they can be more honest. And I'm sure in the process you're really giving them quality therapy. I mean,
well,
would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of what the experience has been, that they really feel like there's an adult sitting in front of them that is just wanting to know, just wanting to understand them. And in some ways, it feels like a new experience for them. Now, and that's not to take anything away from the therapist they're working with, but very often in those treatment centers, even the clinicians go into it with kind of a set agenda. You know, if a kid gets admitted because of aggression, a lot of the treatment focus is just trying to taper down that aggression. So you lose sight of the other elements and the other dimensions of the child sitting in front of you. But these kids, and it could be in part, you know, a lot of times the clinicians don't step out of the experience themselves to just say, is what I'm doing even helpful? And that's kind of what we're doing. I mean, we're able to step in there, not being affiliated with these agencies, and just asking the kids right from the start, all we want to know is if you think this therapy is helpful, this treatment is helpful.
I remember during my training, particularly when I was at Harvard, where they were particularly snooty and arrogant and some of them very psychoanalytic, two of the lessons I got were, one, they said, one of the really top analysts, never ask your patients whether they benefited from a session. They'll always say no. And the other thing was, I said to one of my supervisors, I really like my patients to feel that they've been helped in some meaningful way every time we get together for a session. And he looked at me and said, thank God I don't feel that way.
Oh, geez.
So listen, it's because that's 50 years ago,
yeah,
roughly. But thank God you're doing what you're doing, Bob Fultz. And let's go to the music and to break.
Okay.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, the conscience of psychiatry. And my conscience really gets, disturbed when I think about how little I've been able to do about stopping the abusive diagnosing and drugging of children. I've written 4 or 5 books that directly address it, talking back to Ritalin, the Ritalin fact book. I've written, titles I can't even remember about trying to help kids. And every one of my recent books has sections in it about how kids are being drugged and diagnosed and injured, how it's making chronic mental patients, making people who don't believe in themselves, believe in their ability to run their own lives, people who think that the pill is the answer, and people who will be over a period of years seriously impaired, and inevitably, if it goes on long enough, irreparably impaired by these drugs. And I've started to talk even more strongly about that, especially as the literature continues to confirm my worst predictions years and years ago about how damaging the drugs were going to be. And I really appreciate my guest, Bob Fultz, for working in this painful arena where he has to daily look at these abuses and I think atrocities, and where he has to calmly work to help as best he can. And I'd like now to maybe bring back Bob. And Bob, you can talk about anything you like, but I'd love to hear some really experiences of your own with working with the kids and also with the staff and the psychiatrists.
Yeah, it's been a big struggle. And as you were describing some of the books that you've written, one of the books that kind of it truly did. It set me on a whole new trajectory in my graduate studies, because for years during my undergraduate work, I was working as a mental health technician on inpatient units with adults. And because I was just on the floor for 8 hours a shift, I would talk to a lot of these adults that were most of which were diagnosed with schizophrenia. And I had gone into it with the assumption that what they needed were their medications. I had kind of just grown up with, hearing it wherever and hadn't closely looked at any of the literature. And as I was talking to these adults, the message I kept hearing over and over is, oh, no, I'm still hearing my voices. I just want to get out of the hospital. That's why I'm taking my medication. And I was stunned. I mean, it really kind of started to flip my conceptualizations in a whole new way. But then, as I got into graduate school, a professor of mine slid me a copy of your book, Toxic Psychiatry, and a little post-it note on it, and said, you may be interested in reading this. Because, you know, I started to more vocally challenge what, you know, we'd hear about some study saying schizophrenia needs their medication. And I would say, well, you know, I've talked to a lot of people in the hospital about these symptoms, and they say the medications, what they do, and as you detail in Toxic Psychiatry and then Brain Disabling Treatments, that issue of deactivation, of how the medications subdue their reactions to the symptoms, but it doesn't eliminate the symptoms. That actually set in motion my dissertation, and I don't know if I told you about this in all the years we've known each other, but for my dissertation, I interviewed adults diagnosed with schizophrenia on the experience of being medicated. And
I am aware of that. I think I actually may have quoted or cited your dissertation years and years ago, but go ahead. Work.
Yeah, I sat down with 45 of these adults in a state psychiatric hospital. So these were, you know, the uninsured and really troubled people. And one of the absolute findings that for me confirmed the idea of deactivation was only one of them indicated that the voices went away from the medication. And they did talk about qualitative changes from the meds. Sometimes they would get more quiet or the message would change, but they continued to have the auditory hallucinations and continued to a distressing degree. But what the other big factor to this is that they reacted to them less. So those two pieces of the puzzle, for me, really confirm the idea that, you know, the medications are, it makes the world more comfortable for us to be around these people, but it does not, they don't act like antipsychotics, you know. They just subdue the behavior, they subdue the emotional reaction to the symptoms. So that really set in motion, you know, my interest in the impact of medications and also how medications impact the effectiveness of psychotherapy. That's another area that I've been very interested in. But in terms of working with these really troubled kids, as you mentioned before the break, some of the work can really be heartbreaking. You know, it's an uphill battle for these kids and their families, and many of the families have been really just put through the ringer through the mental health system. They're trying to advocate for their kids, but very often being kind of ushered down in a certain form of treatment that they may or may not be in agreement with. You know, they're often accused of doing horrible things or being inadequate parents and everything else. And without a doubt, parenting can have a factor in how kids behave and how they feel about themselves and everything else. But treatment is not always an optimal alternative. And that sounds pretty critical. And there are so many well-intentioned clinicians that I've worked with. But having worked in residential care for many years, It's a tough place for a child to spend their childhood.
It's chilling just to hear you say, spend their childhood.
Yeah. When that's their childhood memories, that is a pretty distressing, it's a troubling thought. It really is.
Do you get to work with the families, and are they cooperative? From my viewpoint, when I have a young person coming to me for help, I'm about as good as their parents are. That is, I'll be able to help the child with certainty if their parents are working with me and cooperative, and I won't be able to help the child if they're going to undermine the process.
Yeah, that is actually one of the most consistent difficulties in residential care working with families, is actually getting them to participate. In the study we're doing, we've been across 6 different residential centers across the state of Illinois, and it is consistent. Getting these families engaged is very difficult, even when the agencies are willing to send them train tickets or pay for their transportation to the agency. It's just really difficult. And understanding the dimensions of that it's getting a clear idea of what the reason is a very difficult process, in part because the families have been so beat up in the system. But, you know, the other factor is by the time a kid is placed, there have been very difficult life experiences for the family, too. And in some ways, the families just want to disconnect from the child, which is just tragic because that's when the child needs them the most, is when they're going through this kind of experience. but, you know, there are wide-ranging reasons. But what one of the consistent findings is the more the family is involved in the child's residential care, the better the outcomes. So, and in fact, the kids know that, too. In the survey we're doing with them, across the board, these kids want their families more involved. It is just a dramatic finding. For example, just looking at my numbers quickly, it's about 90% of kids that say, I believe that family therapy is important for me to get better.
Wow, they're smarter than their psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Because it really is the, in my experience, you know, outpatient, of course, I'm dealing, you know, rarely with kids as troubled as you are, but occasionally. And with any level of child, whether they're functioning well or not, it's so much about the family. The family, and sometimes I'll tell parents, look, you don't have to be the cause of their problem for you to be the source of their healing.
Right.
So without necessarily beating yourself up about what's happened in the past, what you've done, what other people have done, one fact remains, you are their hope.
Yep.
And when parents can respond to that, kids change at an incredibly rapid rate.
Yeah.
And I often don't even end up seeing the kids but two or three times. And then I work with the parents, and they just keep reporting to me how much better the kids are getting as they improve how they're relating to them.
Yep. And what happens, too, is when kids are released from residential, even if they're released to foster care, for the most part, kids want to reconnect with their biological parents.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. So even if there was, I mean, and I've seen just some horrific experiences of the kids that have been abused by their parents, but they still want to go back. So if you don't enlist their help, you know, it's just setting the kid up for future failure. But the kids know it, like you said. I mean, another question we had for the kids is we kind of, in some ways, we asked these prompts and tried to get the agreement or disagreement from the kids. The prompt was, I believe having my family involved is important for me to get better. And that outcome was about 94% of kids said that they believe having their family involved in their treatment is important for them to get better. And I know for a fact a couple of the kids that disagreed with that had just extensively traumatic experiences with their families and just had come to the conclusion they couldn't go back to their families. But
how common is outright sexual trauma, sexual abuse, and really severe physical trauma? Most of the kids have one or both?
Well, I can't. Let's see. Well, like I said, in terms of the actual number of adverse childhood experiences,
well, they've all had that 4 out of 10, 4.6 out of 10.
Yeah,
I think
4.6. And then specific categories, the physical abuse occurred in about almost 60% of our sample.
Yeah, that's what I would think.
And sexual abuse occurred in just under half.
That they're reporting or is known. So I think we can assume that, especially for the sexual abuse, if you're finding out about 50%, it's a lot higher.
Yeah, that's fair. And part of what our effort is to kind of page by page go through their social history as it's provided to us and find out how consistent their report is from what the records show. But even it may not be in the records, depending on what age it occurred at, right, or, you know, all sorts of other factors.
Well, and as you know, as a therapist, under ideal circumstances when you're talking with someone, it could be a long time before they even realize they've been physically or sexually abused,
yeah,
or will dare to let it enter into their consciousness. I presume with children, I don't know, do you think that perhaps they can reach it more easily and discuss more easily that they've been sexually or physically abused, or do you think it's harder for them?
I think it's harder for them, and I think in part it's a developmental issue. I think particularly as we talk about, you know, a talk therapy approach, I think for kids to be able to develop what I call affective labels or emotional handles on these things, that's kind of a developmental process. And if something traumatic occurred to them at age 6, the experience could be, you know, hugely troubling for them internally, but they may not know how to put it to words. So that's when techniques, expressive therapies like art therapy and music and those kinds of approaches can help to be a catalyst for those. But even at the point where they're ready to put it to words, that too takes a lot of scaffolding of support for them, because once it comes out and they start talking about it, with it comes that flood of emotion, and they need a lot of support when that dam breaks, so to speak. But I see that occurring. Working with young kids is just a very challenging. I work mostly with teenagers. Working with young kids is particularly troubling because that inability for them to articulate what that internal experience is. And it could take years of being in therapy, but knowing that eventually it's just going to emerge just through their developmental progress.
I know when I was a young professional, I thought that it would be wonderful to work with adolescents and younger children and help them before it was too late. But with time, I began to realize that it's very hard to help children and youth because they are so dependent upon what goes on in their families, mm-hmm. that so much of it turns on, will the families grow? Will they resolve dad's alcoholism mom's own issues with having been sexually abused? It just so much depends on, will the family grow? And you're talking about families who created a lot of abuse,
yeah,
and then had to go through, had hell to pay for the abuse they committed,
right?
Because the kids give it back in one way or another. Then they get involved with peer pressures, and they get involved with drugs and sex and violence and other things. And the parents, who were once abusers, are then become disappearing parents.
Well, you know
It's tough,
yeah,
tough work.
The fact you mentioned that, in our sample, losing a parent through divorce or abandonment is one of the adverse childhood experiences, and 60% of the kids that we surveyed so far have had that occur, and just over half of them have had a household member go to prison. So that,
wow.
That piece is a major factor as well. Just, and that if it's a single parent trying to manage a very troubled kid, and if there are other kids in the family, it just becomes so much more complicated.
It does. I grew up in an era of the 60s and 70s when divorce was taken lightly, I know now from the terrible experiences of having been divorced that it does take a toll on the children, and adults have to balance their decisions about that. But I certainly did not, when I was a young man those decades ago, have the knowledge of just how devastating a parent moving out of a house is, no matter how close you stay and
right.
no matter how much you keep that process going. And I'm not trying to push anybody to stay in marriages, but rather just understand that this is an issue of vast importance.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that when you talk about the bond between people, it makes me think of actually a paper that I put together not long ago looking at the role of psychotropic medications and the chemical oxytocin. And as you know, oxytocin is getting a lot of press lately about being a factor in bonding and trust building and forming relationships. It's not the only piece to the puzzle, but it is one piece. And across the board, except for stimulants, across the board, these medications actually appear to reduce levels of oxytocin in the body. Now, most of that's based on animal research, but because the research just hasn't been done in humans so far. So often I have heard, coming up through school and early in my career, that to work with somebody that is really troubled, to do any effective therapy, they need to be medicated first. And what this seems to reveal is that most of these psychotropic meds actually create a disadvantage in their ability to form a connection with the therapist or with anybody else.
Well, our frontal lobes, those flowering cauliflower-like growths in the front of our brain, they got that big and that complex not to build airplanes or internets or to carry on modern activities. We developed this incredible frontal lobe system before we had any known technology. If you go back and look at the first 100,000 years.
Yeah.
And we weren't even drawing pictures when we got these frontal lobes, as far as we can tell. They develop because we're a social animal, a social being. I think we're more than animals, social beings, human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And we are all about our social sensibilities, our social sensitivities, our social judgment, our caring, our empathy, as well as our hates and our angers and so on. We are just created from other human beings after we're born.
Yep.
We're not only made with mother's milk, we're made with mother's love,
yep,
literally. And if we don't get all of that, then we run into problems. To give drugs that impair the frontal lobes is so counter to common sense. And just to remind people, I don't talk a lot about my own practice, to remind people, I since 1968, since I've been in my own private practice and stopped finished my training, I'd have not started patients on psychiatric drugs. If someone comes in hallucinating, I relate to them.
Mm-hmm.
If they're hallucinating badly, I relate to them even harder,
right,
to create trust and caring and the possibility of some communication through all the dread and fear the person's going through. And if a young child comes into my office full of rage and anger, I find that almost without exception, they're glued to me the minute I'm interested in them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I've never given a child a drug. So it is possible to work with the starting point of relationship, and the more disturbed the person, the more the drug will injure, not just by the adverse effects in general, but by cutting them further off from their capacity to relate, cutting them further off from you. So let's turn me into a person who simply feels the drugs do more harm than good. And I just look forward to being there with the people who come into my office, and if they're children, being there with their families, and if they're married, being there with their spouses and maybe their children, and really helping in the creation of healing relationships. And drugs can do nothing but interfere with that really fine-tuning that we have through our development of our brains. So I'm just totally in the camp, as you know, but I don't actually talk too much about it on the air. I'm just totally in the camp of welcoming people to a relationship that I want to be helpful for them. And
yeah.
And I don't diagnose. Develop their stories, help people understand their stories and carry them forward in a better and interesting and more powerful way.
Yeah.
Bob, we've got about 2 minutes. Would you like to take a minute or so and say whatever you would like?
Well, just on the heels of your comment, it made me think of the many decades of Bert Karen's incredibly valuable work. And one of the things that he either wrote about or speaks about is when he sits down with a client, what he tells them is, All I have to offer is understanding, but that's usually enough. And that, when I heard Bert say that, I was just like, wow, it just makes perfect sense. But just, you know, in terms of my own experience, you had asked around the break about my experience with working with psychiatrists. What I have found, and in around Chicago, I really have found some very responsible and thoughtful psychiatrists that I refer to regularly. And when families are trying to get their children off medications, I have found some psychiatrists that are actually willing to do that and collaborate with families in that way. And part of what I would recommend to people is really be critical consumers of this information. If you're sitting down with a therapist or a psychiatrist and you feel like it doesn't add up or you'd like a second opinion, I always encourage people to go get more information and seek out a clinician that you definitely connect with, because those are the ones you're going to make the most progress with.
As I said on Oprah Winfrey, that got me into trouble, but we eventually won. Years and years back, if a psychiatrist gives you a drug and you don't feel you've been cared about and this person's been interested in, you don't feel this person's been interested in you and has tried to understand you, put the prescription in your pocket and don't make a fight about it and find somebody who's going to care about you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Robert Fultz, FOLTZ. You can find him through the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. You're a prince among psychologists. I think the work you're doing is incredibly important, and that you're really right on in the way you view what's going on. And it's the second time I've had you on my show. You're one of the few repeats at this point, and you will be back again. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.